Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the A24 project here on the Nerd Party, the podcast that aims to get under the skin of the films of A24, one of the most prolific film distribution companies in the world right now. In each episode, we focus on two films from their back catalogue in chronological order of release. I'm Dallas King, and joining me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you, Lee?
Yeah, really excited to be talking about these two movies today. This is sort of the kind of movies that you kind of get involved in doing a project like this, well, a podcast like this to talk about. They're so diverse, so exciting, and kind of they really make you proud of sort of British filmmaking as well.
Absolutely, because yeah, I think it's fair to say that when we made up the spreadsheet with the episode lists on it, this was one of the ones that we both got very excited about. And the reason why is because today we're going to be looking at Under the Skin and Locke. In the previous three episodes, the format has been that we'll spend time discussing one film and then moving on to the other. But this week, since we've now caught up, we've given you the first three episodes to listen to, and hopefully you're still with us. And now we're introducing a new feature, which is I like to call the A24-hour news channel, in which we talk about the latest updates on A24 releases. And so the main headlines this week are, bong, 8th Grade gets UK release date. So this is the news that finally the UK will be receiving Bo Burnham's acclaimed film on April 26th of 2019. Now this film initially played at the Sundance London Film Festival back in, I think it was late May, early June. But it's been a while and a long time coming, but it will be in UK cinemas on April 26th, going up against a very small film called Avengers, We're Using Our Made-Up Names. So Lee, what do you make of this news?
Is it any coincidence that our podcast came out last week, which contained three episodes of saying this show will track when this movie is going to come out, and then conveniently, only 24 hours after this podcast has been released into the world of iTunes and people can download it, that they know, well, there's an audience for this movie and it's gone out there. So I like to think we've definitely done our big bit here.
Oh, absolutely. They clearly had heard the first three episodes and went, you know what, these guys, they sound great. They're really passionate about our films. We should probably give them a chance to watch it on the big screen. So, I mean, I'll take a slot out of my time catching up with Avengers to fit in a small screening of this, provided, of course, it does screen at my local cinema. I expect it will be a very limited release, probably counter-programming against the Avengers, but hopefully it'll be something that, the hype has been fantastic. It's had great reviews in America, and it'll be interesting to see also because it'll be coming on the back of a potential awards campaign, because I was looking at the A24 website, and 8th Grade is being played for a couple of screenings for your consideration, along with a couple of other titles. I'm very glad to see that Hereditary's in there, and they're going to be pushing for Best Film, Best Director, Best Screenplay, but also Best Actress for Toni Collette. I would love to see an actress in a horror role be talked about among the big hitters. I expect it'll have more luck at the Independent Film Awards, but I guess we'll just have to see what happens. So yeah, I think you've been tracking this one for a long time and you're very excited to see it, is that correct?
Yeah, I was in London at the time of the London Sundance Awards, the London Sundance screenings, and I was going to apply for a press pass because I was going to be in and around London at the time, but I left it too late and it closed. And then when I was down in London, I was down there for a weekend seeing a kind of couple of concerts and catching up with some friends. And I kept my eye on 8th Grade, like, it was one of the immediate ones that sold out. Hereditary hadn't really kind of sold out, so there was still some screenings, only because it was probably like 2 weeks away from being released, and there was a few other different films like Cameron Post in there as well. But I never managed to get the chance to see 8th Grade, and I kept refreshing in the week up, building up to London Sundance, and then while I was there, never got an opportunity. So almost a year to the day from that, I will finally have the chance to see this movie. So I know you sometimes come down to Edinburgh or Glasgow to see the Avengers or those kind of movies in IMAX as well, so I'm sure you can make a double bill of it if it doesn't show in the bright lights of Aberdeen.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I certainly will. And so the next headline we've got this week is that Under the Silver Lake has exited the Oscar race. I don't know if it was ever going to be planned to be in the Oscar race, but it's moved from its slot from December the 7th, and it has moved to April 2019. Now, Under the Silver Lake is the film from David Robert Mitchell, who made one of the best horror films of the last sort of 10 years, and It Follows. And it originally screened at the Cannes Film Festival to, I think, a mixed response, and I think there was talk of potential re-edits going on. Now, the film is centers around a man called Sam, and who's intelligent but without purpose, who finds a mysterious woman swimming in his apartment's pool one night. The next morning, she disappears, and Sam sets across LA to find her, and along the way, he uncovers a conspiracy far more bizarre. Now, this was one of the ones when sort of Cannes was coming out that I was really hoping was going to find its way into the Edinburgh Film Festival, but I think with all this talk of re-edits and stuff like that, maybe that's maybe why they missed out on Edinburgh. But I'm hopeful to see it when it eventually comes along. It's just a shame that we're gonna have to wait to sort of 5 more months to see it. So is this one that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, it's a bit an odd one. We had the kind of the trailer a bit earlier in the year, then it seems to be getting pushed back and pushed back for a release date. So it kind of, you know, when you kind of get a bit of a publicity campaign so early on, and then what unfolds is delays, it becomes a bit of a something that makes you kind of pause for thought of, is this something that they're trying to, you know, as you're seeing, it's kind of dropped out of potential Oscar talk, if it was ever kind of really going to be going for it, to being something that's kind of maybe getting dropped earlier in the year. So it seems a bit of an odd one, so I'm curious to see what kind of state it comes out in early next year.
Well, again, it gives us a bit more time to work through the rest of the back catalogue, so you know, it's not such a bad thing for us, because we do have a lot of films to get through. I think now that Eighth Grade has been sort of slated for April in the UK now, I think actually we're only going to be on episode maybe sort of 17, 18 by that point. So, you know, we've still got a long way to go, because I think there's about 36 episodes or so far already scheduled, but they keep releasing and sort of scheduling new films. And there's two more films that we need to talk about because they've just been announced. Now, the first one is called Green Knight, and this is from director David Lowry, who directed A Ghost Story for A24 Films, and is also going to be back in cinemas soon with The Old Man and the Gun, which was apparently Robert Redford's final film, although he's starting to walk back on his retirement in the same way that sort of Steven Soderbergh does every now and again. And this is going to be a sort of fantasy epic based on a 14th century story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And this is a pitch, and I'm already hooked by this pitch, because it could work as a horror film, but it could work as a fantasy as well. And the story goes that one of the knights of the Round Table accepted a challenge from a green knight, who challenges any knight to strike him with his gold sword. In exchange, the offending knight must take a return blow 1 year and 1 day afterwards. Gawain accepts the challenge and instantly beheads the Green Knight, only for the knight to pick up his head, walk away, and remind Gawain of the end of his bargain. So immediately, I'm really interested to see how that's going to play out. It's almost sort of like a horror film, and he knows that this guy is coming a year one day. What does he do with his life in that year? And a bit, it'd be interesting to see what kind of take Lowry puts on it, because I thought A Ghost Story was a really interesting and powerful look at the afterlife, and I'm really excited to see what he might do with this material.
Yeah, you saw what he did with something like A Ghost Story, where it spans almost centuries into the future and into the past, and what he's going to do with sort of a year in the life, really. He captured it so well over such a long period of time, so it'll be interesting to see how he kind of narrows that focus into a year, and what sort of meditation on life he's going to kind of provoke with that. So yeah, he's certainly proving to be one of the most kind of exciting filmmakers at the moment, with sort of such diverse films. You know, you go from something like, you know, A Ghost Story and Pete's Dragon to, you know, An Old Man and His Gun, and then something like this. He's really is one of these directors now that you'll kind of go see anything that he does for just the name alone.
Absolutely, and I think it was just announced this week he's going to be quite busy, because apparently he's going to be working on a TV adaptation of Explorers, the sort of 80s sci-fi film that had Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix in it. So it's going to be, he's going to be a busy man. It's going to be interesting to see again his take on that. And the final bit of news this week is the announcement that A24 will be distributing The Lighthouse, which is an upcoming American black and white dark fantasy horror film directed by Robert Eggers, who has already directed The Witch for A24, and it will star Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. And that is all the information that we really have on that. So I mean, Robert Pattinson has really, for me, made some very interesting and bold choices following Twilight, looking to sort of escape the shadow. And I think he's done a great job so far. I think we'll actually be discussing him soon in The Rover. But what do you make of this news?
Yeah, again, it's like Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart have, you know, they received, you know, you look at the reviews their acting had and the reputation they had over those years that they were doing the Twilight movies, and that for a lot of actors like that, you've seen it in movies like Star Wars and even some of their co-stars in something like the Twilight movies. You know, I think of that guy who played the werewolf, for example, his name escapes me, which kind of says it all, that their careers have completely crumbled and maybe it's just the convention circuit for these people. But, you know, they've continued to star in great movies. You know, they've been all working with such exciting filmmakers. So, you know, a Robert Pattinson movie is, again, something to always be quite excited about. He's going to be a bit of a recurring actor over kind of the next few years on this podcast. So, yeah, he's going to be, you know, I think that'll be his third A24 movie. So he's becoming a bit synonymous with the brand as well.
Absolutely. So lots to look forward to from A24, but it's from the future we look to the past. And the first film we're going to discuss this week is Under the Skin. And Under the Skin is the 2014 film directed by Jonathan Glazer, who made Sexy Beast, Birth, and some of the best sort of music videos of the late 90s. And it's based on the novel by Michelle Faber. Debuted at the Venice and Toronto Film Festivals and then finally in the UK at the Glasgow Film Festival in what I still consider to be the best year of the Glasgow Film Festival. How can you better have a festival that opened with the Grand Budapest Hotel and then ended with Under the Skin? I mean, just an absolutely fantastic selection there. Now, the film tells the story of an alien that drives around Scotland in a white van, luring men to their deaths. I'm just going to leave it at that because we'll get into sort of more detail later on, but it's interesting to potentially look at it, what it actually has in common with the book. Now, Lee, I believe you were trying to read the book in the advance of this podcast. Did you manage to finish it? And what did you think comparing and contrasting the two?
I feel like a kind of pupil turning up without having done their homework, but I swear I had the most stressful, busy weekend. I was away in Glasgow on Saturday, so I was like, right, I've got all day Sunday to do it, and then kind of Monday evening, and maybe a bit of Tuesday. But my girlfriend's been really unwell, so I've been kind of sort of having to look after her. So I feel like I've got a good excuse, and I've got an alibi for this. So unfortunately, this is going to be something that's going to go on for a bit more for me of reading the book. So I kind of read a bit of the cliff notes in the summary of the book, so it certainly is a bit different, but I'm a bit gutted that I wasn't able to do my homework for this one.
I accept your apology because I myself have that book on my bookshelf and have never got around to it. I bought it before the movie, but then found out that the movie is basically it's very much a starting off point with the book. It takes the very bare bones of the story of an alien driving around in Scotland looking for men for a nefarious purpose and becomes something else entirely. So it's okay. I accept your apology, but I want it on my desk next week. So Under the Skin was originally a Film 4 production, who, in my mind, are very much what I would consider the A24 of the UK. They're not afraid to champion young or established filmmakers, and particularly sort of ones that want to make challenging titles. Some of their work has included My Beautiful Laundrette, The Duke of Burgundy, In Bruges, Dead Man's Shoes, the Oscar-winning Ex Machina. Now, this was their first collaboration that was released with A24, and they've now gone on to release 12 films together, including the aforementioned Ex Machina, also the Oscar-winning Room, and American Honey as well. So this was shot entirely in Scotland, and a lot of it was shot potentially sort of almost sort of fly on the wall, rather surreptitiously, with hidden cameras and stuff like that. There was a lot of improvisation, and you know, you heard all these stories of basically Scarlett Johansson was in this van driving around, she had the black wig on it, and people didn't realize it was her. Now you think, how could that possibly be? She's one of the most beautiful and most famous women in the entire world, but somehow people in the outskirts of Glasgow didn't realize it was her in the van. But when you finally see the film, it actually makes total sense, because on the strength of her performance, which for me is still her finest performance on screen, she's just completely, you know, for lack of a better word, or to excuse the pun, completely alien. And, you know, she's got a blankness behind the eyes, you know, which sort of comes into the plot later on, which we'd like to discuss later. But I mean, I thought she was absolutely superb in this. But Lee, I mean, what were your first initial thoughts sort of going into the film? What were you looking forward to, and did it meet your expectations?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the first time I went to see it, and I remember going into it really excited. I think it was like probably the third A24 movie at this sort of time where I was really sold on the ad campaign, like Spring Breakers and The Bling Ring. And I remember just seeing these trailers and the hype and the buzz, and it was like, this is a film I'm desperate to see. I really can't wait to go along and see it. So I went to see it in your old cinema, the Belmont Cinema. So it was my kind of, I think I was up in Aberdeen for some reason, and I found the time on a Saturday evening to go along to the screening. And I remember it was quite a cold night. It was late March, something like that. And I went into this screening and I was just absolutely blown away. I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I'd sort of heard more of the salacious parts of the movie, you know, nudity, it's set in Glasgow, you know, these sorts of things that kind of, you know, you hear about a movie like this. And it wasn't quite at all what I expected. I was expecting something quite mysterious from the trailer, but to have a movie like this where it tackles so many big themes by saying so little, and you know, the scope and the scale and how beautiful it makes Scotland look in places like the borders and in and around Glasgow. It's, and the score as well, that wasn't what I expected at all. And I came out of it and I just started texting my friends going, oh my God, I've just seen this film. It was absolutely fantastic. And, you know, a friend replied back, you know, I've read the book. I love the book. Do you think the film will kind of be anything kind of like it, will be as good? And I was like, well, I've not read the book. And here I am 4 years later, still in the same boat. But I remembered him going, saying, well, I don't know what the book's like, but you've got to see this as a film. It's what you kind of go to the cinema to see, is a movie like this where it's just an absolute experience. It's terrifying, the performances are fantastic, it's something that leaves you on edge all the time, and it's something completely original. And it was probably one of my favorite films of that year, definitely in the top three or four of that year. I loved it, and I still enjoy thinking about it when I watched it the other day. You know, some of my favorite scenes in it just still pack a punch, you know, whether it's the scenes on the beach or in the, you know, the climax of the movie. There's just so many moments in there where I think, wow. And you know, I'd finished watching it again on Saturday afternoon, and I was through in Glasgow for a friend's book launch, and I was just like passing by some of the streets just thinking, oh yeah, that's where Scarlett Johansson tripped up, that's where their van was kind of driving around. And it was really exciting to see a country and a place that, you know, represented like that on screen in such a unique and brilliant movie. And I'm still excited this day thinking about it. What about for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, this was, you know, watching it, it seems, and I'm going to go on a slight tangent here, but it seemed like a very almost experimental film in the way that they filmed it. It's like, you know, they maybe didn't have a script at points, they just sort of filmed it and went and just wanted to see what would happen with Scarlett Johansson interacting with all these Glaswegians. And I mean, some of the dialogue for me as a Scot was slightly difficult to understand, so I've no idea how it would play in America. I imagine they would definitely need subtitles if the person who was contracted to make the subtitles could understand what they were saying anyway. But I mean, it sort of felt like sort of Blade Runner 2049, and that, you know, I thought Blade Runner 2049 was the best film of like last year, and I thought, I still can't believe that someone gave, you know, Denis Villeneuve $150 million to make Blade Runner 2049 and didn't interfere, and that was what we got. And I was so pleased that that's what we got. And it kind of felt similar to this, but it took, to be honest, it did take me a couple of viewings to sort of know whether or not I really liked it. I went back to my initial review that I wrote back in 2014, and this is sort of what I said at the time. The Urban Dictionary definition for the phrase under the skin are as follows. 1, when you meet someone and you're drawn to them, you can't stop thinking about them even though you don't know them. Something about them just sparks something deep down in your imagination. It starts to run wild and you're physically and emotionally altered. They fascinate you. 2nd definition, someone really pisses you off. They said something and you can't ignore it, so you have to say something to defend yourself and your feelings. It makes you mad and almost at a loss for words. Some rubs you up the wrong way. Now, both of those definitions could probably be equally applicable to this film, because there are some who will think it is an absolute masterpiece, and there are some who think it's the worst thing that they've ever seen. For me, it was like Only God Forgives, which also came out that year, in that it split audience's opinion, and I wasn't exactly sure what I'd seen, but I knew that I had to see it again, and on second viewing, I was correct in my initial assumption in that it was an absolute masterpiece. I just thought it was undefinable, but I just was drawn to it in the same way that these men are drawn to the sort of siren's call of the Scarlett Johansson character, who just lures them in. Essentially, you know, we'll start to get into sort of spoilers in a second, but essentially lures them to their doom through her sort of use of sexuality and flirtation and stuff like that. And so, I mean, a lot, like you said, a lot of it's down to the music. This was Mika Levy's first film score, and it is so unique. And it was nominated for Best Music at the BAFTAs, sadly not at the Oscars, but, you know, she's gone on to do the score for Jackie as well, which I thought was another fantastic score. So I really hope that, you know, she gets more work in the future, because it's just such a unique sound that I want to hear more of. It's just, I mean, you almost can't get it out of your head once you hear it. The sort of the use of the strings and everything is just fantastic. But I mean, Glazer's direction, I mean, I think in my review, I compared him to like Kubrick and Rogue and Lynch in sort of the use of the visuals and surrealism in order to create this sort of ambiguous story of what you're not into. You're never, it never explains what is going on. And I think that's part of its power. It leaves you to sort of speculate and fill in the gaps and stuff like that. And I mean, yeah, if you'd read the book, I'm sure you've got a better idea of what is actually going on. But even then, it probably diverges from it slightly. But I mean, I've got some theories about the film, but we could talk about that in a minute when we sort of get into spoilers. But was there anything else on sort of first initial viewing that you thought was excellent, or anything that maybe you didn't like on first viewing?
I think it was one of these ones. I loved it. You know, there was nothing that came out of it. Like, I think when, you know, I always think of things like Letterboxd, for example, where, you know, you see so many films in a year, especially people like me and you, we see films at festivals, we go see wide range of quality films at like the Cineworld or local independent cinemas with our cards. And how many times do we, when we're updating a Letterboxd, going, hey, I've just seen this film, do you put in like 5 stars? And sometimes it feels like it's this journey through, you know, nearly 100 films, 200 films, you know, seeing 3 or 4 films a day at a festival to find that 5-star movie. And when it comes, it's like that hits the elusive 5. And sometimes a film will be perhaps a 4 in my mind and go up to a 5. But I remember coming out of Under the Skin and just going, that was a 5. And it was, you know, when I, you know, we all have these discussions about Netflix and films in the cinema and, you know, is it ever as good as home? I couldn't imagine sitting here talking about Under the Skin and having that sort of connection with it if I'd watched it at home first and not the cinema, where you're transfixed by the screen, there's no distractions, there's no phone lighting up with a notification about, you know, Domino's pizzas or anything like that. It's like you're completely transfixed, and that is your first ever experience with a movie like this, and you don't have, you know, you don't improve on it in the second one, because that was a perfect experience. It's not like you watch it in this at home and you think, man, that film must have been great at the cinema, I'll maybe try and catch it one day. You just have that perfect moment in time watching it, and that's why it's a 5-star movie. And there perhaps might be flaws in it, but because of that experience and that immediate connection, it's definitely a 5, and probably one of the best films of the past, you know, 5-10 years. And in some respects, it's certainly right up there.
Absolutely. And I think what you sort of talking about flaws, I mean, you know, I'm not sure if the film for me has any flaws, but the flaws of the characters and stuff are sort of what I'd like to sort of discuss now, sort of going into spoiler territory. So if you, at this point, if you haven't seen Under the Skin, pause the podcast, go and watch it and come back, and we'll see you in a little bit. But I want to talk about what the characters were. Now, the film starts off with a sort of rather almost 2001-esque sort of shot of sort of lights and circles and stuff, and then it basically becomes an eye, and it seems to be the sort of manufacturing of the aforementioned skin, because the aliens essentially wear sort of human skin in order to blend in. And this is followed by a guy on a motorbike sort of driving around and then picking up a woman's body, putting it into the back of a van where she's stripped off. And then Scarlett Johansson takes her clothes. And I've always believed that this is Scarlett Johansson's taking over from this other female alien that has met her end either through a grisly end or natural causes. And what I believe is they get the guy on motorcycle, and again, you see a few later on, which sort of indicates that there are many of these things going around. And he is the sort of bodyguard carer for this person. And the female aliens are there to, you know, lure these men to their deaths. And one of the most beautiful yet disturbing sequences I think I've seen in any film of recent years, just the way that these men sort of are following her on this completely black surface and then slowly get sort of dragged underneath while she's still walking across it. It's just such a beautiful sequence, but utterly terrifying. And basically, she has no empathy to begin with. She's very cold, but slowly but surely, she seems to connect with the world, become more curious about it. I mean, the guy's always sort of checking her eyes, looking for something, whether it's almost like, you know, how this Uncanny Valley sort of thing where these CGI characters, the problem of connecting with them is that they're dead behind the eyes, but at some point you start to see life behind Scarlett Johansson's eyes as she becomes more involved in the world, and along with certain characters as well. And this is what ultimately leads to her downfall towards the end of the film, where she's exploring life, she becomes too familiar with people, and ultimately it leads to death and destruction for them. So, I mean, what did you think of that aspect of the film, and am I talking a load of nonsense, or am I on the right track?
No, 100%. No, 100% agree with your analysis. We're definitely in sync here, and I think that's somewhat probably surprising in the respect that this is a film that is very ambiguous, that I would love to read what the actual script is for this movie or how much they actually had, because as you kind of said earlier on, there was a lot of improvisation that they were essentially picking up these men, and they didn't, apart from the individual with the deformity on his face, no one else knew what they were kind of getting into. You know, they would be picked up, and I think that was really interesting, because, you know, I'm sure we'll have something similar with Locke, where they had turned basically this white van into a sort of a mini kind of set, really, where you could have all these cameras built into different parts of the car and just filming Scarlett Johansson driving around the east end of Glasgow and the surrounding areas looking to pick up these men. And I read a really interesting thing when I was kind of watching it, where, you know, women are told, you know, if someone drives up to you and approaches you, oh, come for a lift and give me a lift, right, you would walk a million miles in the other direction. Whereas in all of these cases, and, you know, bar one, these are men that voluntarily went into these cars, and, you know, they didn't know that they were going to be shot for a film. They didn't know if they were even going to be murdered, raped, or sexually assaulted. And that's a real interesting thing, I think, to think about, is that sort of different gender reaction to essentially being picked up. And these men ultimately did go to their doom. And, you know, it's a real sort of gender swap from what genuinely possibly could happen to people of the opposite sex, and why men will kind of blindly walk into a situation like this. And in this case, they ended up in a film. But in reality, you know, potentially in reality, it could have been the other way around.
Absolutely. I think one of the strengths of Scarlett Johansson's performance is how she's able to turn on a dime. There's, I think, the one you were talking about, the one person who didn't get in the van, she's sort of asking, well, are you going to meet someone? Yeah, I'm going to meet someone. And immediately you can see it behind her eyes. She switches off. She's like, okay, fine. She drives off. She's only looking for single men that can't be traced back to her and whatever. So she immediately says, I'm off to see someone. She's like, okay, right. And basically, off she goes, drives on to the next one. And then, of course, she ends up talking to someone about where the M8 is. And then you've got this bizarre conversation, which I don't think has ever happened in another film starring the world's most bankable actress, where they're discussing the location of an Asda. And then then later on, when she's talking to the Adam Pearson, who's sort of appeared on sort of British TV programs and stuff like that, but he's got, I think it's fibromyalgia, and he's like talking about Tesco's and stuff like this. And you're thinking, I can't believe that this is in, you know, this film where Tesco's, where people pluralize supermarkets in the UK. It's just one of those random things, but it totally works in the context of the film. And yeah, it's just, it's a film which it could so easily have gone wrong. They're banking on, you know, these authentic real interactions, which, as you say, could have gone any way, but somehow they've managed to craft one of the most, you know, profound and beautiful sort of films ever made, I think, actually, certainly in Scotland, because it does.
Yeah, that scene as well, where she's talking with Adam, and it's one of these ones, I think, as audiences, and I think for Scarlett Johansson's character, you're sitting there and you feel such pity and empathy for this individual, and you've seen what's happened to the other men by this point, and you are willing him to you know, avoid it, to potentially escape this doom that really all the other men have gone to. And you sort of start to see that kind of process in Scarlett Johansson that I think every other man up until that point, it's been really interesting, it's been a kind of very sexual experience, and as an audience member you're like, okay, I'm gonna go with this, I'm gonna see where this kind of unfolds, you know. And you see these two characters undressing in front of each other, and then you see it kind of in this situation, and as an audience member, because of his kind of disability, you immediately changes. You're like, you don't want to see the titillation, you don't want to see the where this is kind of potentially going to go, what this mystery is. You just want to get out of there. And I think as an audience member, you start to squirm in your seat that this could be someone that's going to be taken advantage of and die. And it's such a relief that in the end he manages to leave and escape, and you start to see the kind of this character start to become perhaps that bit more human, and learn what it is that kind of makes humans so special sometimes, is that empathy and care for others.
Absolutely. He escapes momentarily, but that's another spoiler. But one thing I was reading about the film sort of leading up to the podcast was apparently Adam Pearson and Scarlett Johansson sat down and talked to each other, and he sort of basically told her how to basically seduce him, because obviously the way that she seduces all the other men would it be very different in this situation. So he basically sort of told her ways that she could basically seduce him, and sort of, you know, discussing like his disability and stuff like that, ways to use that to basically get him on side and more interested in her and stuff like that, because obviously he is thinking, well, someone like this is never going to go for someone like me. So she changes her sort of seduction patterns to basically suit the target and stuff like that. So it really is a fantastic performance, and from both of them in that scene. And you know, sometimes Scarlett Johansson is very underrated, and I mean, she was fantastic when she first broke onto the scene in sort of Ghost World and Lost in Translation, but for a while I guess people maybe seem to synonymize her more with the Avengers movies and stuff like that. But for me, I mean, you know, when she finds the right role, she can be a fantastic actress.
Yeah, and I loved it. She had something really interesting to say about this movie, which makes me kind of wonder what the script was like, because she was talking about Jonathan Glazer's shooting method for the film, and she was like, it's hard to describe what his method is exactly, but to me it seems he has a process of finding a scene. It may take him a period of time to find the rhythm of it, find the music in the scene, but once he does, he homes in on it full steam ahead. He can see the shape of the scene as it's forming. And he's very specific, but oddly at the same time quite unspecific. It's a process of finding the material. And I find that quite fascinating, because you think of someone like perhaps Scarlett Johansson, where, you know, she starred in movies like these big blockbusters, you know, at this point probably the Avengers and Iron Man 2, where, you know, these sorts of things are like, you come on, you know, every day is absolutely precious, you know, you're shooting to a schedule. For something like this, like the fact that she's even involved in a movie like this with so low budget, there's so much improvisation, it must be really exciting as an actress, and perhaps terrifying as well, to open yourself up to this thing of like, we don't quite necessarily know what the film is going to be, how it's going to unfold, and seeing it at a time starts to kind of come together in perhaps the edit, perhaps in the acting, perhaps in collaboration with another actor. And I find that really fascinating, and I would love to know what it's like to be involved in that kind of film, what it was like as an actress and an actor.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, this is a film which, you know, for me has certainly got under my skin. You know, I'll watch it sort of probably at least once a year. I've had the poster on my wall at work, I've got the poster at home. You know, one time when I was in Glasgow with my wife, I sort of dragged her around Glasgow, going to the shop in the places where the film was shot, and then sort of took photos, sort of screen framing, trying to match up exactly what was behind her as it went down the escalator in Buchanan Galleries. I was along on the sort of Eros Road and stuff like that, next to the bit where she trips over and falls. So, you know, this is a film which has sort of stayed with me for a long time. And what do you think it is ultimately about the film that has gotten under your skin, and sort of, you know, sort of wrap up, sort of final thoughts on this particular entry in the A24 catalogue?
I think it's one of these ones that it's, you know, it might sound a bit pretentious, but it's almost like a work of art, that the dialogue is so minimal, but it's filled with so many beautiful images about humanity, what Scotland in its kind of, you know, its urban areas and its kind of beautiful countryside. And it's got this incredibly creepy, alien at times score that really makes it sort of like a, you know, an art experience where you're just sitting there and you're watching all these different images saturating your mind. And, you know, the things we're talking about, the, you know, the eyes at the beginning, you know, these bikers going around the streets, the scene, for example, where we never spoke about it, but the scene where she's at the beach and there's the baby crying, there's so many scenes in there that just, they are drilled into your mind, and like you remember them almost like you were walking around a gallery, and you could see these images just shot after shot, and you can piece them together. And I just think it's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, and it's terrifying as well. I just think it's one of these great, great films, and I'm so glad that, you know, someone like yourself loves it and other people love it as well. It truly
Absolutely,
is a special
yeah, no,
movie.
I think, yeah, before we wrap up, we need to talk about that scene on the beach, because yeah, it features one of those images, which is the baby crying on the beach in the dead of night, that will stay with you for forever. I think it's just one of the most sort of heartbreaking and sort of horrific sort of things. But, you know, it's like, it's a film which has so much horror, but it also has so much beauty. It's that juxtaposition, you know, this alien finding things about this world that are actually beautiful, even though she's only there really to sort of to take from the world, but she finds this sort of the beauty within as well, under the skin of the earth, I guess, is what she's saying. You know, there is more to this planet, to these people, than what she's there to do. And that's just one of the fantastic things about the film. And I'm just looking at, you know, Jonathan Glazer is the director who sort of did Birth, which was a very underrated film back in 2004, but he hasn't done anything since Under the Skin. And he apparently does have a project in pre-production, which is potentially going to be a World War II drama. It doesn't really say anything more apart from it will be looking at sort of the Holocaust. So, I mean, showing what he's done in the past with these films, it's very interesting to see his sort of take on that sort of material. But I guess, you know, on this week's A24, we do have a running theme. You know, Scarlett Johansson spent a lot of time in Under the Skin driving around in a van. Our next film is set entirely within a car as well, and that is the 2014 film Lock. Now, it was written and directed by Stephen Knight, not Stephen DeKnight, who is the man behind sort of Daredevil and Pacific Rim Uprising, but Stephen Knight is mostly a screenwriter. He was Oscar nominated in 2002 for Dirty Pretty Things. He's also written Eastern Promises. He's currently in cinemas. He wrote the screenplay for Girl in the Spider's Web and has written and directed Serenity, not the John Cusack one, but the one coming out this year with Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey. Now, this was his second directorial feature after Hummingbird with The Staith. And this one, as I said, set in one location, a car, as it follows the journey of Ivan Locke, who has left his job the night before a major development to be with a woman giving birth to his child. Hardy plays a man who builds things for a living, but sees everything around him come crashing down over the space of an 80-minute car trip. Now, what were your initial thoughts on Locke? What did you know about it going in, and, you know, what did you make of it when you first saw it?
This was one that I don't know how, but I missed this one at the cinema. I was potentially on holiday at the time or something, but I remembered like all this kind of hype about it's Tom Hardy in a car, and you watch the trailer and it's quite ambiguous about what's he done. You know, it could be something really dramatic. You know, you hear people complaining about things and there's some sort of drama going on, and it's, what could it be? Is he going mad in this car? It's really hard to tell. So this was a film that I had to wait until it came out on home video for, so I eventually managed to pick it up. And I was quite surprised going in. I don't want to say I was let down, but I was perhaps a bit surprised at first that it was something very low-key, that it was just a man that had an affair and was driving to London to be there when the baby was born. And I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. But Tom Hardy's performance is fantastic in this. And, you know, the film is only about 80-odd minutes, but it flies by. And what is essentially just watching someone, you know, on the phone, driving away, having conversation with people from all around the world, and it is incredibly gripping while you're watching the movie. It's real impressive, and Tom Hardy, as ever, is, you know, he is in every single shot, he's in every single scene, and he is just brilliant as always. And I thought it was a really impressive performance, and yeah, I think it's a testament to what can be done with a really good script. You know, only a week to shoot in, that you can actually make something that's really fascinating, and, you know, that you can make a film as something as small and interesting as this, and there will be an audience for it. It doesn't all have to be, you know, big blockbusters. You know, movies like this are just as exciting. Absolutely. And interesting.
This is a film which I did see at the cinema. I think I went basically because it had Tom Hardy in it at this point. You know, he'd been in The Dark Knight Rises, Inception, Warrior. You know, that was one of my favorite films of 2011. I just thought it was superb. I thought he was brilliant in it. So by that point, I was like, I will see anything that Tom Hardy's in. And yeah, as you say, on paper, this film should not work. It is just 80 minutes of a man in a car on his phone. But it is all down to A, Stephen Knight's script and Tom Hardy's performance. I'd be interested to know if in anywhere in that script, if Ivan Locke is explicitly said that he is Welsh, or if this was just a decision that Tom Hardy decided to do and go for. I thought it was it has to be. I mean, his choices, vocal choices in all his films are very interesting. A lot of people sort of are down on Tom Hardy because of his sort of mumblecore approach to things and sort of Taboo, even in sort of Venom and stuff like that. They thought he was a bit sort of mumbly, but, you know, when he finds the right role and stuff, I thought he was brilliant in this. And it is all down to him. He has to command your attention, and he absolutely does for the entire 80-minute. And basically, this is a film which plays out in real time. This is him driving, I think it's from Birmingham down to, he's heading down to sort of London. I think it's Luton he's trying to get to. And initially, you know, he's making calls home saying he's not going to be home tonight. And they're like, oh, why aren't you? You know, you've got to be here for the match. You know, we're watching the match, Dad. Why aren't you here? And he says, I've got to take care of something. Put your mother on. It's like, oh, what's he done? What's he done? And it's, as you say, it sort of transpires that he's had this affair and this woman is giving birth that night. But for me, as much as, you know, this is a family drama of a man's family being basically destroyed by this admission, I have to say that I was entirely gripped and more interested in the subplot, which was the concrete pour. I have never been more invested in a storyline about concrete than I have during Locke. Now, essentially, Tom Hardy's character is the site foreman of this build. They're going to build, you know, the Birmingham's tallest skyscraper. You know, I think I've got it written down here. I took a note. 350 million tons of concrete from 218 trucks are getting poured the next morning. He's not going to be there, but he comes across as an honourable man. He wants to try and do the right thing, which is why he's driving down to be with this woman, even though they only had, like, they slept together one time, but he's doing the honourable thing. He wants to be there for the book because she's got no one else. And he's basically spends this entire car journey wanting to make sure that this concrete pour goes correctly. He does this by phoning his assistant, who is an Irishman who, I swear, I thought the entire time I watched the movie for the first time, I thought it was Chris O'Dowd. It's not. It's Andrew Scott from Sherlock. He has to talk to his boss. He gets fired, but he still wants to do it. You know, he's talking to people in America. He's talking to the local council and stuff. And it's utterly gripping. It's like, I've got a quote here. It says at one point, you don't trust God when it comes to concrete. You trust me. And he's basically trying to do everything to make sure that this goes okay, because, you know, he can't be there. He knows he's messed up, but he's trying to do the right thing. And, you know, I was utterly, and the film ends without a resolution to that story, and I've never been more upset. I really wanted to know if the pour went okay. I was like, I just want to know if the pour went okay. I hope it went okay.
I had the same sort of thing where I was thinking, like, so I was reading an interview with Stephen Knight where he was talking about that while he was sort of researching this film, he spent time with the man who built the shard. And he started, like, you know, involvement with it when it was just like a patch on the ground, and he finished it when the project was finished itself. And he was like, the idea of organizing that, he'll get in his car, drive home, and no one will know who it is. And that was also one of the kind of reasons for making the film, to look at the ordinary and make it dramatic. And I think that, like, they totally achieved that. Like, I was more interested in the poor than the story of their affair and love. And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm watching the movie, and you're almost screaming at the TV going, you can make it back in time. Like, you've only probably just gotten off. If you get down to London, that'll maybe be sort of like midnight at the latest. You can be back in the morning for the 5 a.m., you know, getting it all kind of done and dusted. You can be there for the poor. And I was just felt so stressed about this building. And I was like, I think you're frustrated because you're watching a man make terrible decisions and you feel that he can be doing better here. I think even one of the phone calls where it's like, could you not have just lied, said you are not well? Why did you have to be so honest? And he's always being honest, you know. I told them you've been working here for 10 years, 9 years. You know, I was telling Chicago, you know, you've been with us for 10 years, 9 years. And it's just the fact that I think that happens three times in the movies. He's just honest to a fault. And I think that he is ultimately a man that if he was better at perhaps keeping his white lies in check and wasn't so honest, he could have probably balanced all his problems and been there for the poor. It's so stressful.
I know. I think a lot of that, so the character comes out, you know, he's having these almost sort of ghostly conversations in the rearview mirror with his father, and he clearly has daddy issues. He's clearly, his father was not there. He probably was, you know, an alcoholic. He probably cheated on his mum and stuff like that. And he clearly does not want to be the man that his father was, who was a liar and a cheat. And he, you know, even though it will cost him everything, he needs to be honest and clear in what he's doing. And I know you're on edge the entire time. It's like, you know, when the Irish guy phones up and he says, okay, you know, what does it say about the concrete? He says, okay, yeah, no, they got the C5. He says, no, C6. It has to be C6. Do you know how many concrete, you know, it has to be C6. I will talk you through this. I will get you through this. And it's just like, you know, he's doing whatever he can and you're just screaming and thinking, it's supposed to be C6. He told you C6. Why you got C5? No. And it's like, oh, you're so invested in the story. And
I hope that's a fizzy drink you're having.
And I just had a couple of beers and he's like, oh God, what am I going to do? And it's like, he's trying to get this done. And you are with Ivan Locke because, I mean, you're with Ivan Locke the entire way. You know, the camera never leaves the car. Although even though that Stephen Knight finds interesting ways and different camera angles in order to, you know, change up the, you know, the shots and stuff to make it, you know, so it's not just one static shot. You know, he makes it interesting. He makes, you know, he makes interesting choices and on where the camera is at the time. And, you know, it's just a fantastically gripping, it should not be as gripping as it is, but they've delivered something fantastic. And, you know, looking down at the cast list just now, if you tried to get this cast for a live action film, it'd be very difficult these days. But I mean, the woman who's having his baby is Olivia Colman. His wife is Ruth Wilson. Andrew Scott, said before, was, you know, the person. Alice Lozen as well. And in a bit of a Marvel fun trivia for you, Eddie Brock Venom, i.e. Tom Hardy, his son is played by Spider-Man Tom Holland. Now, what did you think of the vocal performances? Because these people only appear over the phone.
Yeah, it's really good. And I was reading how they sort of did it. So obviously they were sort of trying to shoot this film in real time. So while Tom Hardy is genuinely driving down the M8 or whatever it is, that he's driving down it, and all these other actors are in a hotel nearby in a conference suite, phoning in when required. And I would just love to watch maybe a bit of a behind the scenes documentary on how this cast were sort of involved and what they were doing sort of in this conference suite while kind of essentially killing time between their phone calls. And I think it's really good. Like, you know, even Tom Holland's character is called, I think it's called Brock, is it? It's Eddie. It's Eddie. So, yeah, like, even that's got a little bit of a nice Spider-Man twist on it. But, yeah, it's such a great voice cast. And, you know, even down to the lines like, fuck Chicago, and, oh, yeah, I'm just having a drink, or, you know, I'm having a curry. There's so many great vocal deliveries in this, and I'd love to know how they even cast these actors. Was it based on their voices? Was it how they did this whole process? I'd be really curious to know how Stephen Knight put this all together.
I know, yeah, it would make for a fascinating sort of behind the scenes, or I'd love to maybe hear director's commentary over the top of it. But, I mean, this was filmed sort of 2013, so, you know, this was pre you know, Civil War. This was before Tom Holland was on the radar for Spider-Man and stuff like this. And, you know, he'd, I think he'd probably just done The Impossible and stuff. So he's transferred from stage, you know, Billy Elliot to movies. So he's just sort of starting out at this point. But, you know, it's all the vocal performances are on point. You know, Ruth Wilson is fantastic. And Olivia Colman is, I think she's brilliant in anything she does. So it's just great to hear this. But it all comes down to Tom Hardy. And he's got great chemistry with everyone he's on the phone with. And, you know, I think it's one of his fine. I think it was probably his finest performance. I mean, I thought he was brilliant last year in Dunkirk, very underrated. Again, delivering a performance, you know, inside a cockpit. You know, his mouth is covered. He basically tells a story with his eyes. I think he's one of the UK's finest actors, and based on this alone, I would watch anything that he's in, because he's always going to give you something interesting, something different, and always makes you know, great choices.
Absolutely, yeah, it's certainly a treat of a movie, and again, it shows the diversity of, we can go from a sci-fi epic to one man in his car talking about concrete, and we can be just as gripped by both of them. I think it's a real testament to this kind of doubleheader.
Absolutely, and I think we're actually reaching the end of our journey on episode 4 of the A24 project. So on the next episode, we're going to be watching Obvious Child and The Rover. So if listeners want to be part of the project, just watch those films and let us know what you think of them on either at Join Nerd Party or on one of our personal Twitter accounts. But also, if you are enjoying the podcast at the moment, please go to iTunes and leave us a rating or a review, 5 stars. It would really help us out in sort of publicizing the podcasting and helping us reach more people. But until next time, Lee, if people want to discuss any A24 films with you online, where might they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Lee_Nostromo, and you can find both of us on the Filibuster podcast, where there's sometimes we do have a bit of a crossover between something like this podcast and that one, but we also talk about original films, big blockbuster films, and a bit of everything else in between. So yeah, you can find me on both those kind of places.
Excellent, and you can get me on at champcelluloid on Twitter and my blog championshipcelluloid.blogspot.com. But for now, Lee and I are off to get into a lift in a white van with Scarlett Johansson, so we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.